My name is Andrew Stewart, and I am a member of the Rhode Island Media Cooperative. 2016 has proven to be one of the most eventful years in recent memory. One element that is particularly taking up a substantial level of interest is the issue of minority rights. In a year where groups like Black Lives Matter have been making headlines on a weekly basis, it seems that a great level of political activity and attention is being paid Black and Brown people and their votes during this election. In order to better understand this group, I have spent the past year talking with voters across America, asking them about both the election and what they hope to hear talked about the day after they cast their ballot. We now present to you the results of those conversations.
Imam Fareed Ansari is the Imam of the Muslim American Dawah Center and is an African American Muslim. So, election cycle and what it has brought up for the Muslim community in Rhode Island.
Well, I think, you know, it sort of prioritizes our concerns, you know, regarding because of the atmosphere, the anti-Islamic atmosphere, the anti-Muslim atmosphere that's been created as a result of this current election cycle, particularly when it comes down to, you know, the I consider it a threat of Donald Trump's being elected to the presidency. I mean, it's something so threatening to the Muslim community as far as the perception that he's created this anti-Islamic, anti-Muslim rhetoric. So obviously it's something that we are very much concerned about.
What are some of the issues that you have faced in the last year as an imam, both in terms of the non-Muslim community, but also just things your congregants and members of your community have been facing and dealing with?
Well, it's sort of like a two-edged sword. On one hand, the interfaith community has been very receptive, very supportive, because of the anti-Islamic sentiment that's being sort of spawned as a result of the Republican convention, a possibility of having Donald Trump elected and to the presidency. And it's very, very threatening, and clearly it's, you know, something that's being looked upon very seriously. But we've been here in Rhode Island, have been very fortunate because of the activities that we've been engaged in the past concerning the interfaith relations that we've had. So we've been, on one hand, it's been favorable, but on the other hand, it has also created a lot of it's changed. You know, things are changing. I mean, you know, particularly when they had the primary here, there was a lot of sentiment towards the Republicans. You know, the Republican agenda, which is again something that I was frankly quite surprised to see here in Rhode Island. So that's something that we've been dealing with, and it's something that I'm concerned about, and it's something that has been addressed. You must have heard about the incident that occurred out in South County at the mosque, where the mosque had been defaced, and a lot of obscenities and you know, basically a hate crime that was perpetrated there. So that's the kind of thing that's been, you know, sort of, it's happened. A lot of anti-Islamic sentiment here in Rhode Island that has manifested itself, you know, there, you know, a year ago at the school. So these are things that we've been dealing with as far as this Muslim community.
It's interesting you mentioned the results of the primary, because it was a very overwhelming victory for both Bernie Sanders in terms of him in that primary, but also the results with voters who voted Democrat instead of Republican. It was a very extreme gap.
Yes, yes. And I was surprised, quite frankly. But then again, it sort of was a litmus test, is what's happening nationally. And I'll be, you know, I'm personally very, you know, it's a concern. I mean, I think rightfully so. It's Islamophobia. You see a kind of, you talk about radicalization Islamically, but there's a lot of radicalization and politically, you know.
Right. The point that has struck me this year is that this has been a sort of populist upsurge against what has been called for a long time consensus politics, and that was seen in both Trump and Sanders. And of course, that always has entailed, in one sense or another, hatred of a certain group, whether it's religious, ethnic, or other identity element. Do you have any thoughts on that sort of perspective?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm always concerned about these type of, well, you know, when I think about historically, you know, what led to the Civil War, you know, what created this divided the country, and literally resulted in a civil war, which was harmful and dangerous and bad enough, but to have this kind of atmosphere of red states and blue states, you know, things are just not that way. I mean, you know, we shouldn't, you know, we hopefully we can live up to the, you know, the American ideals that are there, that we, you know, pluribus unum, you know what I mean, out of one many. You know, our country is very diverse, and I mean, we should be evolving towards that, not digressing back into sort of the darkness and the dark ages of segregation, of racial segregation, of religious bigotry, and so on and so forth. You know, I would hope that as Americans, we can, you know, evolve to the kind of values that were promulgated early on, you know, with the founding fathers, that are there in the Constitution. I mean, much of what, you know, Donald Trump is saying and promoting is unconstitutional, number one. I mean, it's just it's unconscionable as well, you know, to even hear a person who is running for public office to be in this kind of rhetoric even being acceptable. It should be something that should be that should be throwing up a lot of red flags for most Americans. I mean, just even as Americans, that attitude, you know, that's being fermented, going back to, you know, the communist rhetoric, the kinds of you know kind of talk that led to the surveillance of Americans under the counterintelligence program and that kind of stuff. My hope as an African American and as an African American Muslim is that we would, you know, evolve to live up to the ideals that as Americans that we promulgate, that's promulgated in our Constitution, this, you know, these guarantees, you know, these freedoms that we talk so much about. But when it comes down to when it's challenged, we want to regress into a whole nother, I can't even describe the kind of, sort of tyrannical and authoritarian, you know, totalitarian kind of rhetoric and attitudes towards others, albeit, you know, black or Japanese, you know. I mean, looking, you know, when we went to war with Japan, a lot of the, you know, rhetoric that came out of that to demonize the whole people, which led up to the internment of Japanese. And, you know, just the other day, yesterday, we celebrated the victory over Japan Day here in Rhode Island. And, you know, I think we're the only state in the United States that still maintains that type of sentiment towards Japanese Americans. I mean, you know, I think it's time to rethink a lot of that you know, that kind of feeling to, you know, that promotes the kind of mindset that would still celebrate the victory over Japan. You know, when you think about what happened in Nagasaki and, you know, and dropping the atomic bomb on Japan, I mean, that doesn't necessarily, you know, resonate with my, you know, with me personally, where I would think that, you know, when I look at Japanese people, you know, are we still looking at them, you know, and although I'm sure, I don't know if Donald Trump would think that this is politically correct to be calling Japanese Americans Japs, you know, I mean, because it's a very derogatory term that was adopted during that time, you know, but we don't want to, I would hope that we don't go back to that, you know, but it's there.
Right. The last time, in my sense of this, that we had a real populist upsurge that seemed to be challenging the margins of the political discourse was the 60s and the period that actually gave birth to the growth of the African American Muslim population. And one of our friends, Richard Loban, has actually said to me on one occasion that he's getting reminded of 1968 quite often due to the events going on in the news. I wonder what you think in those terms.
Well, yeah, I mean, look at the resurgence, you know, Black Lives Matter. I mean, it's still, he has to have to make that a public or movement to indicate that, yeah, I mean, don't all lives matter, but why is it that the emphasis has to be placed upon Black life simply because Blacks are being still victimized by a lot of police brutality and, you know, bad apples within the law enforcement community, you know, although it's, you know, the ordinary, you know, police officer on the street, not to mention a lot of the, you know, surveillance and kind of things that were going on in the 60s, which, of course, I personally think that maybe that a lot of that stuff is still happening, particularly with the Muslim community, you know, similar to when the 60s, when that type of permission was sort of given because Blacks, the Black experience, you know, it was, you know, this terminology represented a clear and present danger, which seems to be, that was the language of the day then. Now there's a whole different, you know, coded language that permits them, you know, meaning law enforcement, to go ahead and, you know, extrajudicial kinds of, you know, behavior that's sort of sanctioned, you know, whether or not lawfully or unlawfully, because under the Patriot Act, you know, we go, that brought us back to a period in time that, you know, permits this kind of activity to take place. Because if you know, if you're labeled as anywhere, you know, like as far as Muslims are concerned, once you're labeled as terrorists or supporter of terrorists, and Islam is being demonized to that degree, that, you know, is something as simple as sending in a charitable donation to a group that is on their list of terrorist organizations or whatever, then you're targeted, as innocent as it may be. So yeah, a lot of that stuff is happening that is reminiscent of that period in time, and that is a concern. You know, that is a big concern. It's a concern of mine, and I'm sure that people who lived during that experience would see a lot of the same signals that are sort of creating that type of, you know, atmosphere, at least. And, you know, Donald Trump seems to think that, you know, he doesn't have to be politically correct. He doesn't have to be correct at all, as far as I'm concerned, because when anyone, you know, can utter... there's some of these sentiments promoting violence, you know, and encouraging, you know, civil unrest. I mean, really, that's irresponsible. I hope and pray to God that this man does not get elected as the president, because that would take us back to a time that I feel would create another, you know, situation here in America that would lead to a lot more civil unrest as it did in the 60s.
Right. So, having touched on earlier the element of the Red Scare that seems to be recurring again towards Muslims, I wanted to talk about maybe trying to briefly articulate a way to deflate that sort of paranoia, because a lot of it comes from a place of ignorance and misunderstanding. For example, in the period of the Red Scare, the accusation was that communists were getting orders from Moscow and they were double agents. And now that has shifted to Islamic countries, be it Saudi Arabia, Iran, wherever. And the motif would be in the discourse that Muslims are taking orders from these different countries, when in fact they might just be reading religious teachings by imams or scholars that live in different countries. Are you seeing anything like that coming around?
I haven't directly, but indirectly, you know, in terms of when I see behaviors that are, you know, totally Islamic, and I see that there are elements that are within, allegedly within the Islamic community that are being, and use, once again, using the code word, being radicalized by these people who are fermenting this kind of, or being this type of radicalization. And yeah, I'm sure they are, because we're witnessing some behaviors that are being attributed to the Muslim community. However, if people within the Muslim community are doing and behaving in a way that is anti-Islamic, then it has to be condemned for what it is. I mean, you know, this notion of the radicalization, you know, of Muslims, you know, oftentimes when I hear this kind of rhetoric, you know, I don't know if you read the book, The Devil's Game, you know, which talks about for over maybe 6 or 7 decades, you know, going back to colonialism and the strategy that was used to divide and conquer, you know, Islamic countries and so-called Islamic countries, I should say, or to more or less utilize groups that within these countries to like you mentioned the communism. Well, that these groups were used to against the communist influence within these countries, like in Syria, like in Lebanon, and other countries that were that the United States was combating, not, you know, the United States, England, France, and others that were trying to prevent the spread of communism. Well, they were supporting some of these so-called these marginal Muslims were being used by the Western powers, you know, the United States, England, France, in order to divide or to fight against communism. So they created their own kind of, you know, the Al-Qaeda. I mean, it's no secret that Al-Qaeda was initially, you know, organized to fight against the Russians by the United States, the CIA. I mean, you know, that's all documented. There's nothing, you know, no secret. But this goes back even way beyond that period in time. I mean, this has been a strategy to divide and conquer, you know, countries, so-called Islamic countries, going back to the Ottoman Empire and, you know, things that led even to the fall of the Ottoman Empire. So this has been happening within the Islamic community. There have been elements within the Islamic experience or the Islamic community that goes back centuries that the, you know, West has been involved in trying to ferment dissension. And they've led to these radical groups themselves. Their hands are not clean, so to speak, in terms of this radical element. That what now we're seeing another, you know, sort of a hybrid kind of radicalized imams who are, you know, being used as well, both for or against, you know, the if it's in favor of the interests of it could be England or France or the United States, then they support them. If it's unfavorable, then they try to, have someone else, you know, get rid of them themselves, or they'll have some proxies fighting among themselves. But whoever is supporting the interests of some of these Western countries, then, they'll finance them. They'll give them weapons and so on and so forth. So, you know, we gotta see, you know, see things for what they are. And for the, as far as Islam is concerned, the Islamic values have been undermined within and from without. So it's a very challenging time for most Muslims. And I don't think most Muslims are even aware of a lot of the other intrigues that are occurring even within the greater global picture, so to speak. Because, I mean, you know, you mentioned the fight against communism. But part of the fight against communism was supporting some of these Islamic groups. And I personally, I think this ISIS and these other people, they don't represent the true Islamic core interests. If anything, they seem to be fighting against Islam. And with the recent attack in Medina, the one of the most sacred cities in Islam, you can't tell me that these people who claim to be trying to establish a caliphate are honestly Muslims or represent Islamic interests. To me, they don't, obviously, because of their behavior defies everything that Muslims stand for. That's why all the confusion. Many people, I would dare say that even Muslims are confused with ISIS because it's only mixed signals. Because on one hand, you're reading the Quran, you should know the Quran, and then you see when this is opposing what they're doing in terms of, you know, they're creating more harm than good. When Islam says, you know, promoting the good and forbidding the evil, that's part of, that's almost an axiom within Islam, you know, to promote good and forbid the evil. But seemingly they're promoting evil and forbidding the good, quite to the contrary.
So one of the things that happened this year that has quite impressed me was the fact that American foreign policy was put into a sort of interrogation that it hasn't been put into for a very long time. And in particular, you saw Bernie Sanders refuse to go to AIPAC and instead give an address where he really took the bull by the horns and spoke out in defense of the Palestinian cause, regardless of whatever flaws it had. That is something you would not have seen 4 years ago or 8 years ago from a Democratic candidate. And it was somewhat striking to some commentators because Hillary Clinton ended up trying to go to AIPAC and out hawk a man who had lived in Israel on a kibbutz. So I wonder what you would like to see, if you think a window is opened up from there, because we're talking about blowback in foreign policy. What you would like to see in terms of either legislation or civic dialogue coming about in our discourse towards the international scene and foreign policy?
Well, when it, as it relates to Palestine?
Or to Islamic matters in general.
The Palestinians?
The Palestinians, but also Islamic members, countries in general.
Well, I think that the American interest is going to be what is going to be the dominant, motivation. If it promotes the interests of the United States, then they will. I think their foreign policy will always be aligned with that the interests of the United States. I mean, I think that to some extent it makes sense, because we have to be just, and we should be equitable, if we are going to take the higher, road as the United States. The United States is in a unique position. I mean, I think we'll probably be damned if we do and damned if we don't. But we should follow the best course of action. And that's very difficult, particularly in the world that we're living in. But we have to stick to our guns and stick to our, just that's figuratively speaking. in terms of principles and values, that we as a country, try to promote. If we expect to have the kind of, or envision the kind of world that we wish to establish, and we always talk about freedom and, the freedoms in terms of our conception of freedom as Americans and liberty and all of these other values that we hold so dear. That if we expect to, have those established universally, then we have to live up. We have to be examples of that, we have a foreign policy, particularly when it comes down to the use of drones and other kinds of, I don't endorse that type of. That type of unilateral, extrajudicial kinds of things that we as a country are involved in trying to do foreign policy, that's part of it. Now, when it comes down to the Palestinian situation, I've been to Israel, and I think that what is going over there is so unfair, so unjust to establishment of the kibbutz and all of these other, literally taking over, Palestinian lands and these settlements of Jews. And, I'm sure that many Jewish people are, particularly Jewish Americans, are not in, they sort of support that unilaterally. Whatever Israel does, Israel can't do any harm, can't do any evil. I've been there, and I see that as being that wall that they build. When you think back in terms of what the Nazis did to Jewish people, I mean, what's up with that wall? I mean, I don't know if you've ever been there to Israel to see that, but it's such a oppressive regime that is being established by the Israeli government, and it's just terrible as far as I'm concerned. So whatever we can do as an influence that the United States can do to alleviate that type of conduct, I mean, we give Israel millions and millions of dollars, because it there's certain relationship that the United States has with Israel that to me, we don't have any control over things that they do. They seem to, you know, defy, even, I mean, look at when Netanyahu came to address Congress. You know, you would have thought that he was treated like the President of the United States. And the President didn't even attend that joint session of Congress, to my knowledge. I mean, so once again, I suppose I'm not favoring. I don't favor a lot of the present policy. I applaud Bernie Sanders' effort to try to do, you know, to try to present an alternative. But obviously, that alternative is perhaps what may have led to his not winning the Democratic nomination.
Right.
So I don't think we're ready for the likes of Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. We're not ready for that as a country, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know.
So moving to the other direction, what would you, as an African American, like to see talked about, worked on, or developed in Rhode Island and the wider country?
And well, in Rhode Island, I mean, you know, the same, you know, Rhode Island is a microcosm of what's happening in America in general. You know, I think, you know, we have to really, really begin to deal with the remnants and the vestiges of slavery, racism, which is alive and not well, you know, here in America. And the fact that America was founded on this notion of white supremacy, which still pervades the consciousness, whether or not it, you know, it's been forbidden. Slavery obviously has, thank God. But the Jim Crow laws that are still there, that established under that type of the inequalities that still, you know, exist in terms of opportunities. So there's a lot that has to really be dealt with to hopefully, you know, get rid of that type of cancerous mentality, you know, that seems to linger on until there's some real, when you talk about affirmative action, that language that came out of the Brown decision, you know, and that was an effort to take some so-called affirmative action. But here we are, you know, over 50 years later, and there's still a lot of the same problems, you know, going on that is going to has ruined this country in terms of its social relationships between, you know, the races and you know, racism in general is just a sickness that has to be cured. It has to be, otherwise it's going to destroy us. It's going to destroy us as a country. You know, going back to, you know, the time when, you know, the very establishment of the United States, which was established on, you know, the subjugation of blacks. And that mentality still, whether or not people can recognize it in its different forms, it's still there. And America, I would hope that, I don't know if it happened in my lifetime. I mean, you know, when I see the likes of Donald Trump and that mentality, it only, you know, it seems to be a resurgence. You know, I had an opportunity to, you know, travel down in the South, you know, not too long ago, and they're still flying, you know, the Confederate flag. You know, you would have thought that, you know, that type of sentiment would have been abolished. You know, if someone tries to raise you know, the Vietnamese flag or the Japanese flag or any other flag in America that we fought against and Americans died over, you would think that there wouldn't be that type of sentiment would not be allowed, or that type of because what it does is it just divides us more and more. But there's always going to, apparently there's always, you know, here we are 2016 and there are those vestiges of pockets of racism. You know, I think the Southern Poverty Law Institute monitors all of these groups that are, they're there, you know, they're there still promulgating hatred and animosity towards, you know, different races and different religions. And Donald Trump doesn't help. He's not helping. He's just, you know, letting, you know, his campaign ride that wave, riding the wave of hatred and animosity, racial, although he uses these, you know, these coded words, but the sentiment that he creates against Mexicans, and he has no problem speaking out and creating this bias and prejudice against, you know, Muslims, against Mexicans, against women, and you know, those who are physically, and, you know, I guarantee you one thing, if he said something against the gay community, he would be done tomorrow. Or if he said something against the Jewish community, because then he would be done. That would be the nail that in his political coffin. But as long as, you know, people are okay with this anti-Muslim rhetoric and this anti-Mexican rhetoric, they're okay with that, apparently, because he's gotten himself in a position where he's nominated by the Republican Party. What does that say about the Republicans?
So, taking into consideration, as I mentioned earlier, you came of age in the 60s and 70s, and that was a time that's very much like what's going on with young people of color today around Black Lives Matter. Do you have any thoughts or words of wisdom that you would share with them?
I sort of have very mixed feelings about that, because of, I know that, you know, statistically, I suppose there are more Black lives being, you know, destroyed by Blacks themselves, that saddens me. And yeah, I know that the police brutality continues, but, you know, we have to do a little self-examination as well and see what's happening within the Black mind. I mean, if Black lives matter, then you need to stop, Blacks need to stop killing their own kind. And you know, not only that, but selling drugs and other kinds of evils that seemingly are acceptable within the Black community that we should be fighting against, you know, also as vigilant, being as vigilant and concerned about what's happening within the Black community, and not only those people that are being perceived as being, you know, inimical to Black interests. But yeah, we have to examine within our own communities what is going on in our communities that something's wrong with that picture as well. When we know that there are, you know, Blacks killing Blacks, and, you know, the violent rhetoric that is going on in terms of the rapping, you know, that industry, the gangsters, gangsterism, drugs, and other forms of violence, it may not necessarily be as graphic as a police officer, you know, killing a Black person, you know, engaging in certain behaviors that are being resulting in death. I see a lot of things that are resulting in death in the black community that blacks are not holding themselves responsible. So if black lives matter, then we need to, it should matter to blacks too.
Are there any other points you would like to bring up in closing?
Well, you know, like, you know, just this, the mere fact that we have in this conversation, it's a hope, you know. I still remain hopeful in terms of my own community and being a member, obviously, of the black community, but also being, you know, American Muslim, that somehow, you know, this kind of dangerous rhetoric will subside, and that Muslims as well as all Americans can be safe and not be demonized and try to, you know, like you talked about the red peril. Well, there was this yellow peril at one point in time, and now it's, you know, the green peril, because, you know, oftentimes, you know, people perceive the Islamic world in terms of colors, you know, green, you know, and I think colors, be it blue states, red states, black against white, this color consciousness has to end, and in order to, it's all part of a scheme to demonize others. So that's, I think, at the core of you know, our problems today, the color problem, because, you know, it's a false sense of humanity when you start, you know, categorizing people in those different kinds of categories, you know, whether or not I have brown eyes or blue eyes or I got black skin or white skin, it shouldn't matter. We're all human beings.
Thank you for listening today, and please tune in for other episodes of this series as they are released by the Rhode Island Media Cooperative. You can follow along through our Facebook page or on Twitter via @RIMediaCoop.